Thank you so much for the invitation. I've looked forward to this for quite a while. Little more notice than the last time I preached for Steve Fontenot. Down in Highlands after Bible class one morning, he says, "You want to go ahead and preach?" Wasn't the shortest notice I've ever been given, but it was a little short, and I enjoyed it then. But I really appreciate the opportunity to come here. Thank you to the elders and leadership here for this opportunity to come and preach the Word. We're going to blend two subjects this weekend, and it's all about faith. We're going to blend the subject of science, how it supports faith, and we're also going to look at the Bible. We're going to look at that a lot through this weekend, and how important faith is, and how we all need to have a strong faith. So I appreciate these lessons because I know that I have taught with this material people out of atheism. One became a gospel preacher. And I know that this is important to me and that it strengthens my faith. Each time I prepare these lessons and deliver these lessons, I'm listening as well. And I need this as much as anybody. And so it doesn't matter if you're really young or if you're old like I am, that this subject is so very important. It supports our faith in God, in the Bible, and the story of creation, which I think you're going to see Sunday morning, is so vital when we talk about the importance of Genesis chapter 1 through 11. 11 chapters, so many people, even in churches of Christ, will write off and dismiss and not believe the importance of, and yet there are over 40 New Testament doctrines that get their basis from Genesis 1 through 11. And I think you're going to appreciate Genesis 1 through 11 even more when we get through talking about the importance of this subject. Tonight, we're going to talk about science versus, in other words, science against evolution. And I want to first of all talk about why this is such an important subject. A number of years ago, my wife and I were traveling to Germany, but we stopped in England for several days, and we went to the British Museum of Natural History. The British museums are a lot like going to the Smithsonian here in America. They're a museum or a system of museums that are free to the public. And we just couldn't wait to go to the British Museum because I've been showing quotations of some of the people who do their work there at the British Museum of Natural History. When you walk in the front door, you see this magnificent hall. And you look and you see this stairway. And it goes up to the single flight and then it goes to the right and the left. And as I walked into that hall, I saw that people were almost as if they were doing obeisance to this statue at the top of the first flight. And as I got a little closer, I realized it was a statue of Charles Darwin. Well, you go up that steps to the left, and you turn to a display of evolution, of what evolutionists say is the demonstration of how we all got here, how humankind got here. And so you see this display, and a little bit to its right, another one with our family tree, showing how we evolved from ape-like ancestors. And sure enough, as I was sitting there looking at that and taking some photographs, there was a parent with children going down the chart and explaining how this explained how humankind came to Earth and how we evolved from these apes and ape-like ancestors. Well, I've lectured a number of times. I think it's 8 different times in the city of Boston. I would never want to live there, but one of my favorite places to go because of the history involved in our country in Boston. Well, you go across the river into Cambridge where Harvard University is, and you go to the history, the Harvard Museum of Natural History, and you go in the front door and a little bit to the left, you see this great display on human evolution where it says, "Understanding our family tree." And right next to that is a skeleton of a human along with that of a chimpanzee. And then this family tree. And just like I had seen in England, and I've been to this museum twice, and I got to tell you, I saw it both times. There is a parent there explaining to their children how we evolved from ape-like ancestors, as if it's a fact. Well, Houston never wants to be outdone, do they? So you go to the Houston Museum of Natural Science and you see this family tree given in a different way, telling the same story. And there was a young, what looked like to me to be a teenager, a volunteer, talking to school-aged children, and he's explaining our family tree and how we evolved from ape-like ancestors. And then you go to Washington, D.C., to the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, and there at the Smithsonian, again, is the family tree that we supposedly all evolved from with the ape-like ancestors. Now, you go back to Harvard, and you notice one of the signs says, evidence for evolution. Evolution, like the theory of gravitation, is an essential truth supported by overwhelming scientific evidence. So just like I was taught in undergraduate school, that even though we refer to it as a theory, we need to really think of evolution more as a fact, there it was at Harvard teaching this to be a fact. Well, I'll tell you, the idea of gravity is a fact. But I think before we're through this evening, you're going to see that evolution and us evolving as the evolutionists tell us is nowhere close to being a fact. I got to tell you another one. When I was raising my children, they were young in elementary school. My older daughter, Jennifer, she said, Dad, they're starting to teach evolution in our science class. And you know what they always do in your schools? I know it's like mine. But they always want parents to be involved and then ask the parents to come up. So I did. It was that science class was during my lunch time. So I come walking in the door and I sign in at the principal's office and what are you here for? I said, well, don't y'all always want the parents to be involved and see what you're doing so you can, show off the good work you're doing educating our children? Yeah, I said, well, that's why I'm here. So I went down to the science class where my daughter was and I sat in. In fact, he had planned on doing this for about 2 or 3 weeks. I didn't even talk during class. It was just my presence. And Jennifer said, you know, Dad, he shut that down in a hurry. So I listened to him for about 4 or 5 days. I don't recall now. It's been quite a while back. To his credit, this science teacher came to hear me give this lesson, the one you're getting ready to hear. He came to where I was doing it in Dumas. And so this man had gone through undergraduate education, has a master's degree, and like me, he had taught evolution. He was repeating it for his students. When he left, he walked out and he shook my hand and he said, I'll never teach the theory of evolution in school again. You've opened my eyes. This is an important subject. So, the Bible and evolution are certainly in conflict. Oh, I know, we'll be talking about theistic evolution tomorrow, and people try to say, you can put them together. It doesn't work, not if you believe the Bible. So in the Bible, we look at Genesis 1. It talks about 6 days of creation. In verse 1, he created the heaven and the earth. Verse 6, and God made 2 great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. This is the 4th day. We'd already made earth. That's not the same order of creation, is it? Now he's making the great lights of the heaven. Verse 26, the 6th day, and God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. One, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the 6th day. In verse 7 of chapter 2, he starts giving the specific creation. And he says, the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And verses 21 and 22, the Lord fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs, and the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, you see, God taking the dust of the ground and making man. And when man is fully made and fully functional, he takes a rib, a bone from this man's side, and he makes the woman. Now that speaks completely, succinctly, clearly of creation. And that has nothing to do with what we are taught in our national parks, on the Discovery Channel, and yes, in our schools, about how we evolve, because that story is not the truth. And I want you to know why. Are Genesis chapter 1 and 2 and Exodus 20, are they fact or fiction? Are they the truth or are they a fairy tale? An eyewitness account. You see, I believe they're an eyewitness account. God was there when he made it. And he tells Moses what to write down as to how he made it. But many of our educators, talk show hosts, and religious leaders will tell you it is nothing more than a fairy tale. So what we want to do this evening is we want to use science and see how science is against evolution. And ask this question, is evolution fact or fiction? We're going to look at three questions. Number one, what is evolution? We need to understand that. And then, science against evolution. And then, why not theistic evolution, which we're going to get into a lot of detail tomorrow morning. So what is evolution? This general theory of organic evolution. You know, when I use this word evolution, it means change. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the general theory of organic evolution. And you need to know it's not a fact, even though many treat it as a fact. It's a theory. It's a theory that all living things have arisen by a materialistic, naturalistic evolutionary process from a single source, which itself arose by a similar process from a dead, inanimate world. It may also be called the molecule-to-man theory of evolution. In other words, can you take an atom and end up with Adam? Can you start out with goo and end up with you? You know, the cosmic says can happen. Go from atoms to Adam, goo to you. Charles Darwin wrote in Origin of Species, 1859, it's a truly wonderful fact that all animals and all plants throughout all time and space should be related to each other. All animals, all plants, along with human beings, are related to each other according to this general theory of organic evolution. That's what this theory says. You know, the brethren over in Cedar Park, north of Austin, I preached a meeting for them a number of years ago, and they had this big, beautiful building, and they said, you don't know how much trouble we had in getting the permission to build this building because they were concerned that it might hurt the habitat of an insect. They finally established it wouldn't. You see, insects are our cousins, according to the evolutionists. And don't get me wrong, I believe environmentalism to an extent, but I think that man was put here to rule over creation. And the idea that we need to be careful from the idea we're related to these animals and plants, that's unusual thinking, in my opinion. Charles Darwin was a brilliant man. He was wrong on this subject. And really, compared to what we know today about science, if you compared him to today's scientist, you wouldn't even say he's a very good scientist. And you're going to see that before this weekend's over. Now, the general theory of organic evolution, and again, whenever I use the word evolution, that's typically what I'm talking about is the general theory of organic evolution. It should not be confused with the special theory of evolution. You see, the special theory of evolution is actually a fact. It describes selective breeding. It describes adaptation within a species or a genetically compatible kind. That's the special theory of evolution. You see, when there's a lot of room for horizontal variation, spaniel and breed it with a poodle and come up with a cockapoo, can't you? Sure, that's a fact. You can take a Pekingese and breed it with a poodle and get a peek-a-poo, a golden retriever and a poodle and get a golden doodle. During COVID, my wife and I went all the way to Pennsylvania to get a golden doodle. We came home with it, and later we learned, and we love little Shiloh, but we learned she wasn't a golden doodle. She was a golden doodle, doodle, doodle. She was 3/4 poodle. You can take a dog and breed it with a dog, and what do you get? You still got a dog. You can have 200 different varieties of grass. When it's all said and done, you still have grass. 300 different varieties of rye, and you still just have rye. You don't have rye turning into oak trees or grass turning into maples. There's no vertical evolution that's taken place. And they tell me that there's 1,300 different varieties of roses. But ladies, a rose by any other name is still a rose. You see, there's a lot of room for adaptation within genetically compatible kind. Now, why do I go to the trouble to explain this? It's because evolutionists do bait and switch. Now, in business, bait and switch is illegal. Bait and switch may put you in prison. It ought to be illegal in science, but it's used all the time, and you're going to quickly see what I'm talking about. They show the fact of horizontal variation within a kind. And they say that proves vertical evolution. So this special theory you have dogs get dogs, well, they prove that or show that to prove the general theory of organic evolution. The idea that you can take 94 chemical elements and naturally occur in nature, or maybe I should say they're found in nature, that you can go from hydrogen to the 94 elements, chemical elements you see in nature, from there to molecules, to bacteria, to amoebas, to animals with exoskeletons, that's a skeleton on the outside, to animals with endoskeletons, those on the inside, and ultimately end up with fish and then people. They do that. Now you're going, what are you talking about? I don't think I remember my textbook, them saying a dog turning into a dog proves that. No, but I'm going to show you a picture you've all seen. Haven't you all seen the peppered moth story? I see some heads nodding. Yeah. You've seen this story. And so here's what it is. The peppered moth, the Abistum petularia, the peppered moth comes in various shades. It naturally occurs as typicals that are light colored and melanics that are dark colored. And when you take the two and put them on a light-colored tree, obviously, to the human eye, the lighter one's more camouflaged. You take the two and put them on a dark tree, and the dark one is more camouflaged to the human eye. Now, 1955, Bernard Kettlewell, a British physician, said, this is Darwin's missing link. You see, Darwin said you'd find it. He hadn't found it, but he said people later would find it. And so Kettlewell said, this is it. It's the peppered moth thing. 1975, 20 years later, P.M. Shepard, a British geneticist, called this. Now, I want you to notice this. The most spectacular evolutionary change ever witnessed and recorded by men. So this peppered moth, this story, it's supposed to be the most spectacular evidence of evolution. Now, how many of you have been in science classes and you've seen this story and you read about it and go, wow, that's pretty good proof for evolution? How do we answer that? I'm telling you, I'm here this weekend not only to show you evidence for God, the Bible, and creation. I'm here also to challenge your ability to think and get you thinking more. Anytime you read a story like this, the first thing you need to do is reread it, think about it, and go, is this telling the story that it's wanting to tell? Or are they playing me for a fool? Think about it for a minute. This continues still to be prominently told in almost all the introductory biology textbooks as proof. So here's the peppered moth story. In the early 1800s, most peppered moths were light colored. During the Industrial Revolution in the 1800s, you know, when all that filthy pollution was out. Kind of reminds me of when I was a kid up in the Texas Panhandle, when I went to Stephen F. Austin State University as an undergrad, over in the forestry department, some of my friends were saying, hey, did you know they were talking about the carbon black plants up in the Panhandle? One of my friends was a forestry major. His dad actually ran one. And I said, Kelly, did you tell him your dad is a plant manager of one of those? He said, no, I didn't bring that up. And I said, well, it's kind of interesting. See, in the Industrial Revolution, that made that look clean. And we've cleaned this up since then. And there was smut everywhere. And so what it would do is it would darken the trunks of the trees. The lichens on the trees would turn black. And it's claimed the pepper moth populations became predominantly dark instead of light. So the claim following the 1956 Clean Air Act, the Anti-Pollution Act, well, the industrial melanism began to decline. It began to reverse because the trees were cleaning up. So this is what Darwin's not the father of evolution. Darwin's the father of modern evolution, and he's the father of the theory survival of the fittest. He came up with this mechanism that the fit survive. And so this fits right in with the survival of the fittest. So you got these light-colored trees. The dark moths are not as camouflaged, so they don't survive much. But then we have the trees becoming black, and the black ones survive more, and the white ones survive. And then it cleans up, and the white ones go back to being more numerous. Now, just ask yourself, does that prove evolution? Think about that for a minute. Is it proof of evolution? Or do you have any questions? This story falls far short of the mechanism for evolution. The only thing claimed to have happened was a change in the proportion of two varieties that were on. Did you notice that? Start out with black and light. They have black and light in the middle of the story and they end up with black and light. Where's the evolution? And how many people have been fooled with a story like this if you believe their story? You see, there was no added genetic material. And if this story is true, if it is, then all it does is show a change in demographics. And he said, what do you mean by demographics? Well, look at the human population. Is there any difference? Oh, look at this auditorium. We all look different. There's short people in here, tall people in here, big people, short people, skinny people, white-haired people, blonde-haired, black-haired, red-haired. There's a lot of variety in our demographics, isn't there? Yeah. You know, when I lived in Dumas as a teenager, we were about 5% Hispanic. In the school system now, evolution? No. There's something that happened where people wanted to move and live in Dumas. That's the only thing that changed. So when you see populations like this, you see an example of variation in human demographics. Just like my community, and I bet you like yours. And what you ought to know is the actual demographic distribution was not consistent. In rural East Anglia, England, very little industrial pollution was occurring. So the typicals, you know, the white ones, were better camouflaged, but were only 20%. That didn't go along with the story. In South Wales, the melanics were better camouflaged. They only reached 20%. And after the anti-pollution legislation, the melanics in north of London decreased, as was expected, but the melanics south of London increased very unexpectedly. And because of all of this, by the 1970s and 80s, biologists realized that melanism is not well correlated to environmental changes. But they keep telling the story, don't they? Even they know the story wasn't really true. If it was true, it doesn't prove anything. But they keep telling the story and say it's great proof. So you need to understand, this story is built on fake news. The facts are not even as they originally were told. But even if it was completely true, it just shows demographic changes. It does not show evolution. But still in the textbooks, to prove evolution, I want to ask you a question. Is that academic honesty? It's not even close. So I think you'll never forget this example. And the next time someone shows you something as a proof for evolution, think, does this really tell evolution? Or do you have some questions? What we've just seen is an example of academic flim-flam, bait and switch. An example of what is supposed to be Darwinian evolution or natural selection or survival of the fittest. Natural selection differs from selective breeding since there's no intelligence directing it. Charles Darwin's idea for the main process that brings about evolution, natural selection, survival of the fittest. Well, let's look at our textbooks again. Those pictures of the pepper moth, they came out of an honors textbook in Texas. It's out of the 10th edition of this biology textbook used by honors high school students. And what it's supposed to do is show how insects evolve and become resistant to pesticides. Now, where I live, we have a lot of agriculture. You can't live up there without learning a little bit about agriculture. A third of all this country's cattle and feedlots are within 200 miles of my house. And because we're so flat, we have a lot of grain, wheat, milo, corn being raised. A lot of spraying goes on either by truck spraying or airplane spraying pesticides and fertilizers and this sort of thing. And it is a fact that what happens is the more spraying occurs, the more you have insects that are resistant to those particular poisons. That's kind of like evolution, doesn't it? Survival of the fittest. And until you take the time to quit listening to the conclusions they want you to believe and start reading even what they say. And you see these pictures like this and you understand them already were resistant to the spraying. And so the spraying kills off the non-resistant and you end up with more percentage-wise of the resistant insects. But there's no mutations taking place to cause these to survive. The genetics is already there. No new genetic information is being added. It's not evolution. It's not micro. It's not macro. It's just survival. So what is it? What about beneficial mutations? We need to understand mutations are the result of damaged genetic information. Often a loss or distortion of genetic information. Most are not fertile. Mutations that are favorable and add beneficial genetic material essentially do not exist. Mutations are different than intelligence-driven genetic engineering or gene therapy. So, evolution, what is it? It's a theory, but it's not a scientific theory. You see, for a theory to be scientific, first of all, you need to be able to check it. You need to be able to observe it. And nobody can observe evolution taking place. And you need to also be able to observe events, processes, and properties that support it. And nobody can do that either. And it must be capable of falsifications. You see, these three things are the scientific method. Every research team I was on, we went through these things. We would say, now, we're going to use a scientific method to investigate this. And we're going to have a way of falsifying this, trying to prove it wrong. And if we can't prove it wrong, we'll feel better about it most likely being right. That's the scientific method. Now, it's with that thought that most evolutionists say, well, that's why creation is not a scientific theory. And brethren, I say amen to that. Because, see, creation does not pretend to be an ongoing process. And so you cannot examine creation as it's taking place. And therefore, you cannot examine events supporting how it's taking place. The Bible doesn't claim that creation is an ongoing process. The Bible claims that it's a historical event, that it's over. That's what the first few verses of Genesis 2 are all about. And God rested. God quit creating. Creation's a historical event, but evolution claims to be ongoing, that it continues. So evolution's unproven, and it's not subject to the experimental method. And if evolution is not a historical fact, and if it's not a scientific theory, then what is it? Well, it's a philosophy. Evolution's a philosophy in the origin of the universe. It's a philosophy in the origin of life. It's a philosophy that says if you take a frog and instantaneously turn it into a prince, that's a fairy tale. Man, it makes me feel like the old-time preacher wants to laugh the pulpit and go, amen. That is a fairy tale. But they say if you take the same frog and give him 300 million years, then we can come up with a prince. Yeah, that's a fairy tale. Now, Professor George Wald, PhD in biochemistry, Nobel Prize-winning professor of biology at Harvard University, said this, and you need to really pay attention to this quotation. It says, time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible. What's he calling impossible? Evolution. Time's the hero. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs miracles. This world-renowned scientist believes in miracles. And he says what causes miracles to take place is not God. What is it? It's time. Time does miracles. So evolution being a philosophy on origin which requires miracles is what? That's the definition of religion. And there's a lot of scientists that have said this very thing. Professor Lou Bunyore, former president of the Biological Society of Strasbourg, said evolutionism is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless. Dr. T. N. Tabmissian of the Atomic Energy Commission said scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men, and the story they are telling may be the greatest hoax ever. In explaining evolution, we do not have one iota of fact. There's no facts to support evolution. H.S. Lipson, professor of physics in the United Kingdom, said, in fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to bend their observations to fit in with it. And then Sir Arthur Keith. I just love this quote because it's so honest. Sir Arthur Keith wrote the foreword in the 100th anniversary edition of Darwin's book, Origin of Species. Now, you don't get to write that unless you are renowned. Evolutionists. They don't pick people like me that believe in creation to write a foreword in Darwin's book, no. Notice what he said. Sir Arthur said, evolution is unproved. And it's unprovable. We believe it only because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. What's the greatest proof of evolution? This honest evolutionist says, not wanting to believe in creation. There's the proof. And if you don't want to believe in creation, what option do you have? You see, there's always only been two choices. Either God made the world or the world made itself. Darwin came up with a mechanism in the 1800s, but it's always been those two choices. So evolution's a religion that is atheism. That's why it's there to explain how we got here without a God. Evolution is a religion that contradicts the two most basic laws of science. Now, my dad was a scientist. He was known for being a gospel preacher, but he was a scientist. And he used to talk about this, the two most basic laws of science. Young people, are we always wonder if our parents are, you know, as knowledgeable as what they might seem to be? I'm in college. I remember it was a Saturday afternoon. There was no college football game to watch. And I came across this statement in one of my textbooks. The two most basic laws of all science. I said, that says all science. I said, I wonder if that really is all fields of science. And so I started pulling textbooks off my library wall and looking it up. And boy, sure enough. What we're saying is there's two laws that scientists have more confidence in than any other laws in science. And it's these two. It's the laws of thermodynamics, second law. Those of you in the audience who are engineers, you're familiar with these laws because your professions are dependent upon knowledge of these laws. The first law of thermodynamics says energy can be converted from one form to another, but it cannot be created, nor can it be destroyed. Someone says, well, if you can't destroy energy, why do we ever have these long lines at the gasoline pump? Yeah, it comes down to law number two, the law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics. This says the total amount of entropy is always increasing. Now, don't worry about that big word, not very long, but it's kind of a big word for some entropy. What it basically just means is disorder. This law says disorder is always increasing. In other words, when there's any transfer of energy, and that could be physical energy, chemical energy, nuclear energy, any transfer of energy is always a certain amount of energy. It's made unavailable for further use. In other words, this law says this world is running down. Most of us make a living off of this law. The plumbers make a living off this law. Yeah, they plumb. I just saw these under here. They make a living off of repairing plumbing. You know, they do some new construction, but they come to your house to fix stuff that's breaking down. That the law of entropy said would break down sooner or later. The electricians, the carpenters. We just had some stuff redone at our house. We got a pretty new house. But the law of entropy just says, hey, it's going to wear out. But see, evolution tells a different story. Evolution says that, no, give us time. Time works miracles, and the world just gets better and better and better. Yeah, that's not what the law of entropy says. So if you're a chemist, a physicist, an engineer, and many other fields of science, you understand what that law of entropy is saying. The world's wearing out. So here's another example of that. Take a look at Sue. Some of y'all know my dad. My dad passed away about 10 years ago. You know how when you look in the mirror, you kind of deceive yourself. I looked in the mirror for years, and all of a sudden one day I look in the mirror and I go, I'm looking at my dad. It seemed like I'd aged 20 years all of a sudden. You see Sue at 90? Yeah, it's the law of entropy. Now, if you think Sue at 90 has changed, have you seen Sue at 3,000? See, that's the law of entropy. This world is wearing out. Evolutionists assume that adding energy, in other words, you've got an open system, you just keep bringing energy in, will overcome the second law of thermodynamics. Well, that's not true. And first of all, we're talking about the universe is everything that there is. Now, if you believe in sci-fi and you've got some parallel universe over here that you can bring energy from, yeah, we're not talking about that. We're talking about everything that's in existence. That's pretty much not an open system. And is this. Adding energy is destructive unless there is a complex mechanism to harness the energy. Let me give you some examples. You'll know what I mean. World War II started when the Japanese added a bunch of energy to Pearl Harbor. They didn't make anything better. They made a lot of things worse, didn't they? Unfortunately, in order to stop that war, our president had to make a decision to add energy to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we didn't make anything better. We brought the war to an end. I'll give you that, and that's good. But those places were leveled. You see, putting energy to something doesn't necessarily make it better. You've got to have a complex mechanism to harness that energy. You're aware of that. leave energy on your son on the top of your car for a while, what happens? The top gets destroyed. The paint job is destroyed. Your house is destroyed with enough sun on it. Not unless you live in the Texas Panhandle. You see, we have so many hailstorms up there. Nobody ever has to pay for a new roof. The insurance company does it. Well, we do have pretty high premiums to help take care of that. But no, you see my point? Energy doesn't make things better. You got to have complex mechanism. You give the sun enough time, it'll just destroy the whole house. And so you can have solar panels, in other words, a complex mechanism, to grab all this energy and do something productive with it. And God made a complex mechanism to use this energy. And you know how much of this world is dependent upon this complex chemical called chlorophyll? Usually packaged in chloroplast. And this is how plants make their food. And people want to say you can take this complex chemical and just evolve it on its own. You see, not only do the plants eat this, but they produce themselves with this food, and animals eat the plants, or they eat animals that are eating the plants. And it's because of this complex mechanism, we're able to capture the energy and do something very productive with it. But evolution's religion just overcomes the two most basic laws of science. It contradicts the law of biogenesis. It says to have life, you got to have life. It contradicts so many facts. And in doing so, it preaches the idea of spontaneous generation, essentially that something can come from nothing, and evangelizes by academic peer pressure. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, you know how it is in school and other academic places, that if you tell people you believe in creation, they'll accuse you of being a dummy. And even in politics, it may ruin your political career. Because, oh, he's so stupid, he believes in creation. He doesn't believe in evolution. That's what I mean by academic peer pressure. And let me show you an example. Pierre Chardin, a Jesuit Catholic priest, said, "Evolution is a general postulate to which all theories, all hypotheses must henceforth bow in order to be thinkable and true. Evolution is a light which illuminates all facts, which all lines of thought must follow." That is what evolution is. I was given this series of lectures up in Purcell, Oklahoma, very close to the University of Oklahoma, and there was a guy who had been a gospel preacher getting his master's degree in English in the audience that evening. He comes up to me afterwards and he says, "You know what? Even in English, we're having to deal with the theory of evolution." Richard Dawkins, many of you probably are familiar with this man, so anti-creation, anti-God, anti-Bible. In his book, Put Your Money on Evolution, he said, "It's absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is, man, that's pretty rough, isn't it? Ignorant, stupid, or insane." Yeah, that's what the evolutionists say about us. Adolf Hitler, Joseph Goebbels, his propaganda minister, said, "If you tell a lie long enough, loud enough, and often enough, the people will believe it." And Hitler said, "People are more likely to believe a big lie than a little one." And friends, that's what evolution is. It's a lie. Let's look at some more science against evolution. Is evolution mathematically possible? Let me tell you what they don't do. They don't do this in elementary school, high school, college, undergraduate, graduate level. They don't get out the math books. They don't get out the computers and show you how evolution is mathematically proven. They ignore the subject of math. I have a close friend, Dr. Charles Goodall, PhD in math education, was a professor of math for many years. And he said, "Man, I wish you could just teach these lessons all over the country." And we have talked about what I'm getting ready to show you in math. He said, "People know evolution is possible, and it has to be mathematically possible. Mathematicians agree that anything with the odds greater than 1 times 10 to the 50th power is considered mathematically impossible. So how complicated is something that only has 1 chance in 10 to the 50th power? It's only 42 parts. It has to be lined up in a particular way. I'll illustrate this. If I had pennies, and I would just take a marks a lot, and I would start labeling them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We'd ask the question, you put a penny in your pocket and pull it out, what's the chance that you can pull it out right on the first try? Well, there's only 1 chance because there's only 1. But if you go to 2, it's a 50% chance. You go to 3, it's 1 chance in 6. You go to 4 pennies, it's 1 chance in 24. Just for the fun of it, my teenage class, a few weeks ago, I took a paper bag. I took 10 pennies, and in front of them, I took a mark slot, and I labeled them 1 through 10. I put them in this bag, and I said, Tim, come up here. You're looking for number 1, but it's blind random chance. Pull it out. So he reaches in there. No, took him 18 tries to get the first one right. All right, I said, you hang on to that one. Now we need penny number 2. The other Tim, start drawing. You know what? First pull, he didn't get number 2. I said, we'll put them all back in. We've got to start over. That's what this is talking about. And you have 42 things, only 42 things that have to be lined up in a particular way. There's only 1 chance in 10 to the 50th power that it could possibly happen. In other words, there's no chance at all. Mathematicians and scientists are careful about using the word impossible. But they'll tell you if it only has that chance, it's impossible. It's not going to happen. So you think about something that has 42 parts. Oh, by chance, it's gone all the way out to 500 parts. 1.22 chance in a 10 to the 1,134th power. So many things in this universe are so much more complicated than that. And yet the evolutionists want us to believe that not only is it possible, that it actually did happen. Evolution's a mathematical impossibility. If the universe was here for 10 billion years, that means the universe has been here 1 times 10 to the 18th power number of seconds. You run this trial I'm talking about with the pennies, with a 200-part system. Pull all 200 out in a second. You say, well, you can't get them out that fast. Yeah, we can use a random number generator with a computer. We can do it every second. You run that every second for 10 billion years. And the chance of being able to get it right once is 1 in 10 to the 357th power. That's why they don't talk about math. Evolution's mathematically impossible. There's not enough theoretical evolutionary time for anything to evolve, much less the human brain that has an estimated 86 billion neurons. That's not even counting the 100 billion synapses between neurons. What are the possibilities the human brain could evolve? Nothing in this life has the ability to evolve. Someone say, well, you know, what about the simple cell? And this is what I said earlier, that Darwin wasn't, compared to today, even a very good scientist, even though he's brilliant for his time. Because he called a cell, a simple cell. Anybody that referred to any living cell as a simple cell doesn't know what they're talking about, dude. That's being nice about it, really. Consider a typical cell. Is evolution mathematically possible, even on a cellular basis? A typical cell has a quadrillion atoms. A quadrillion atoms. Carl Sagan, noted evolutionist, said the information content of a simple cell has been established as around 1 times 10 to the 12th number of bits, comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. What are the possibilities that a single cell could have evolved? It's kind of like this. You get in a game of flipping coins with an atheist, with an evolutionist. And you come up 60 times, all heads. Is he just going to, and I don't believe in betting, but would he just hand you the money? Or would he accuse you of having a double-sided coin? I think that's what come after you. But the same evolution, without batting an eye, will believe that the infinitely less probable events took place. It's kind of like the cosmic casino kept turning up straight flushes over and over again. You see, evolution is just mathematically impossible. Organic macroevolution is actually science fiction. The general theory of organic evolution is a theory that all living things have arisen by this materialistic, naturalistic evolutionary process from a single source. Molecule to man, theory of evolution is what we're talking about here. You got to give them the original matter. I was told a story one time about an atheist talking to God and says, I can do what you did. And God says, what are you talking about? And he says, well, you know, make man out of dirt. Well, God says, okay, give it a try. And the atheist gets around to get some dirt, and God says, no, you got to use your own dirt. Do you see the point? You have to give them the original substance to get started with. Creation is that God made this world out of nothing. Everything that we have, he spoke into existence. You got to give them the original matter. And it's just science fiction to believe that something can come from nothing. That is not good science. It's science fiction to say matter has always existed. And ultimately, that's what the evolutionists tell us. It violates this law of entropy. The molecule to man theory of evolution is the idea of the cosmic egg, that everything came from the cosmic egg. And you need to understand what they're saying. That all the matter in the universe, I heard this three days a week when I was studying astronomy. All the matter in the universe is once collected into one ball, the cosmic egg, some believe smaller than a single proton. And then for some reason, the gravity turned loose and it had a huge explosion that they called the Big Bang. And then everything evolved from that. And that single source, that cosmic egg, was probably smaller than a proton. You talk about faith. It takes a lot of faith to believe all the matter in the universe is once in a ball smaller than a proton. That's tremendous gravity to hold it together. And what kind of force would then cause it to release and all fly apart? That overcame this unbelievable gravity. And that's what they're telling us with this Big Bang idea. And then after this force had overcome that gravity that held the cosmic egg together, then there was another force that overcame that expansion force and started bringing it back together and coalescing matter into planet solar systems and galaxies. The molecule to man theory of evolution is science fiction, but the story continues. They say the solar system is about 5 billion years old, that the Earth came together about 4.6 billion years ago, and then life began to evolve, that everything evolved from element number one on the periodic table, hydrogen. It's got a proton in the nucleus, and it's got one electron. Atomic number one, atomic weight, 1.00794. And from everything else we get, hydrogen. The whole universe evolved with it. And evolutionists say there's two primary theories for evolution of organic compounds. One, they say, well, it probably came from outer space. And the other is chemical evolution. So we look at the periodic table of elements. 94 naturally occurring, we see in nature, and then up to 118 that man has helped develop in the laboratory. And here's examples of these elements. Again, hydrogen with a single electron and proton. We've got oxygen with 8 electrons in its nucleus. And then all the way out to 118, we've got organosin. And this represents this periodic table. Now, did that just happen naturally? That hydrogen evolved into all these other elements naturally? The mathematical probability of that is zero. This is science fiction. But, young people, tell me if you don't see this in your science books. This is called the Miller-Urey experiment. Now, what did I tell you? I'm here this weekend to teach you to think more deeply, to question what you're being told. And so you see this Miller-Urey experiment supposedly showing how organic compounds developed. You've got the cosmic soup, all these chemicals in a soup, and they developed into organic chemicals so we can have life. So what you need to first of all see is you've got a closed system. You go to the scientific laboratory and you have all this glassware set up where oxygen cannot get into this. Now, the reason you have to have a closed system is if oxygen touches any of this, the experiment is over. Now, you remember when we're talking about the cosmic soup, we're talking about planet Earth evolving, and you got these areas where you got the cosmic soup, the goo, and oxygen can't get on the goo or you won't get an organic compound. That's number one. That's why all the glassware. Now, what we're trying to do is to figure out, can you come up with an organic compound with this? So what you got to give them is not just a hydrogen. What you got to give them is, well, methane. Yeah, we got people in here that studied organic chemistry, and it's only less when you learn about methane, isn't it? The C stands for carbon. Methane's an organic compound. So you say, well, can organic compounds just evolve on their own? They say, well, let me give you an experiment and show you how we do it. So give us an organic compound. You got to give them an organic compound. And then you got to give them ammonia. And then hydrogen. And water. And then you got to give it heat. And then you got to have a spark. We're not saying that man, with all of his intelligence, can't make this happen in the scientific laboratory. Because you see, very intelligent chemists have come up with over 10 million organic compounds. My best friend, a roommate in college, world-renowned scientist, he's passed on, faithful Christian, helped develop some of these organic compounds that are now used as medicine. You can do that. But blind random chance? No, this doesn't prove evolution at all. Does this evolve on its own? From the primordial soup out of chemicals out in the open in the presence of oxygen? Well, then if it did, and we know it can't, but let's just say it did. Now, what does it have to have next? It has to have a cell membrane because life cannot exist outside the cell membrane. So here we have a picture of a typical cell. And this, let me tell you now, in undergraduate level, cell biology is 2 semesters for seniors majoring in biology. But that's just the start. Cell biology is primarily biochemistry, and you can get a lot more education about cell biology on the graduate school level. Because cell biology is extremely complicated. And so we're not going to go into all the chemistry of that tonight. What we're going to do is we're going to look at one thing. We're going to look at the cell membrane. The cell membrane, it's a phospholipid bilayer that has protein components in it. It's only about 6 to 10 nanometers in thickness, which means it's extremely thin. And yet it selectively controls the transportation of nutrients into and out of the cell. It's almost as like it's got this intelligence. And it can reach out away from the cell and envelope what it needs and bring it in. It can also get rid of stuff the same way. And there's other ways through intelligence the cell membrane can get rid of and bring different nutrients in. The cell membranes depend on proteins, which are organic molecules. Yet proteins can't function unless they have a cell membrane. A partial cell membrane is worthless. It needs to be fully formed at the beginning or you don't have life. You have death. So we're all familiar with this, aren't we? Because you're familiar with how antibiotics work. So many antibiotics make cell membranes static, where they cannot continue to promote life. Other cell membranes are affected by antibiotics, and they have holes. You ever taken a balloon and put it onto an oxygen machine or a helium machine, and it's turned on the helium, and it gets so big, and then kapow, it blows up? Some antibiotics kind of do that to the cell membrane. They make the cell membrane when it's not very intelligent anymore and allows more and more fluid to come in until the cell blows up. And then eventually, if you kill enough of those bacterial cells, what happens is your immune system takes over and kills all the rest of the bacteria. Now, in high school, college, we talk about mitosis, the division of somatic cells, body cells. And we show in this division where one cell becomes another, what has to take place is the cell membrane has to be intact the whole time. You can see in this diagram that I have up on the screen that the membrane is never opened. It duplicates itself, twists itself off, or you have two cells, but you never quit having complete cell membranes. Because if you do, then you don't have life. The cell dies. But so you got to go from chemicals. Now we got to put the chemicals in the cell membrane. And then we've got to have a cell. So then they talk about prokaryotic cells, cells that don't have a nucleus. The genetic material is just out there inside the cell. And then that evolves to a eukaryotic cell where this cell has made its own nucleus. Got enough evolution going yet that we need to have belief in? All this is mathematically impossible. And yet the view of evolution is this. The Big Bang took place about 10 to 20 billion years ago, eventually to where we have life having evolved and humans being here for the last 1 to 3 million years. They show, and we're going to talk more about this tomorrow, the geologic time column, and they say this is a history in the Earth's crust about how we evolved, and that represents the biologic tree. You see up on this biologic tree a single cell, and how it evolved into plants, and how it evolved into animals, and eventually it evolved into human beings. That's what they say you see in the geologic column. But you know what? The progression of this biologic tree is not in the column. The geologists can't find it. The paleontologists can't find it. Professor Stephen Gould, now deceased, famous Harvard professor, said the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference. However reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. So when you look at this biologic tree that's supposedly represented in the geologic record, they say, well, the fossils just don't support it. This man's an evolutionist. Dr. Colin Patterson, the British Museum of Natural History, said, I fully agree with your comments on the lack of evolutionary transitions in my book. They read his book on evolution and said, well, where are the transition fossils? He said, if I knew of any fossil or living, I would have certainly have included them. I'll lay it on the line. There's not one such fossil, not one transition fossil. David Ropp said, in the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, they have not been found. Yet the optimism has died hard as some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks. Charles Darwin said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, any, which could not have possibly been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down, but I can find out no such case. One thing that's just too complicated to evolve, and Darwin says that's irreducible complexity, and it disproves his theory of evolution. Well, I think everything we've discussed so far pretty much proves this theory of evolution is wrong, don't you? Well, let's look at this. What about the bombardier beetle? You familiar with him? Bombardier beetle has a tail that's kind of like a machine gun in it. And what it does is it produces chemicals and mixes them together. And the heat of those chemicals comes up to the boiling temperature, 100 degrees Celsius, 212 degrees Fahrenheit, and they're also noxious. Now, what's interesting is he has storage tanks. Well, what came first? The storage tanks to store the chemicals? Or the glands that made the chemicals? It's kind of like these refineries you've got down here on the coast. I don't know how many times I've driven by the big Exxon refinery down there. We've got a pretty big one up in the Panhandle about 15 minutes from where I live. The key refinery, Valero's most productive refinery. And what do you have? You have this big refinery making chemicals, storing them in tanks, and what this bombardier beetle has is glands that make the chemicals. The chemicals are excreted into tanks. And then when it needs it, it puts it in a mixing chamber, and then it becomes nauseous and very hot. And then the right diaphragms and muscles squeeze it out into the machine gun, and the machine gun can point at all of its enemies, whether it's ants, praying mantis, or whatever, and shoot it kind of staccato-like, like a machine gun. You got to ask the question, which one evolved first? Did the glands evolve before the tanks? Say, you know, someday we'll have tanks, and we can store this stuff. But we don't know what we're going to do with it now. Or did you get the storage tanks without the glands? And did you have all that without the machine gun and without the mixing tank? You see, it all had to be done at once, immediately, as in creation, or none of it was good at all. You look at a simple bacteria. These bacteria are moved by their flagella. These flagella are pretty interesting because they're pretty stiff, and yet you got a rotary motor. Now, some of you who go out fishing and you got a motorboat, you're going to appreciate what I'm getting ready to show you. Because these flagella in these bacteria have a motor that rotates this flagella and causes it to move. And you get down on a molecular level, it looks a lot like this. It's got a stator, a motor, everything that we use in building a motorboat engine. And yet this is supposed to just evolve on its own because of evolution. Now, what it shows is irreducible complexity, and it shows that evolution's a theory, but it's not a scientific theory. It is fiction. This weekend, we're going to look at some more things, and we're going to see even more powerfully that the truth sets us free, not the fiction of evolution. If you're here this evening and you've not yet become a Christian and you know what it takes to be a Christian and you'd like to obey the gospel, I think the brethren here are prepared to help you. But I want to extend another invitation to you. Maybe you're not yet ready and you want more information. If you'll come and ask us questions, our answer will be with a smile on our face, we're glad you asked. Whether it's about how we know there's a God, how we know the Bible's His Word, or how we know the plan of salvation is what the apostles actually practiced and taught. So if you want to ask, we'll be glad that you ask. Are you here this evening and would like to respond to the invitation? If you do, and if you will, won't you come forward as we stand and sing this invitation song?